you have known, that you have been that kind of participant in.
This session is being video recorded. So if you, as I hope, participate in the discussion after the panel is finished, which will be reasonably brief, please speak up so that the microphone on the video recorder can record you for posterity. Let me first say that I am pleased that the conference went well. And I'm pleased that the efforts we took to organize it seemed to work pretty well. But I do want to say that ultimately the success of a conference is in the hands of its participants. And I think as participants, you have made the conference succeed. I'm going to take a few minutes to make some remarks myself. After listening to the talk here, or at least fragments of the talk, I've gotten the itch to talk myself. But there's not a lot I can say in the time there is, and perhaps I haven't got a lot to say. I want to begin with the beginning and say very briefly that I thought that Manny's opening remarks provided a useful set of issues for those of us who are concerned either with the analysis of interaction as such or the analysis of interaction as that analysis illuminates the issue of social structure, however we might understand that term. It's clear that the problem of relevance, like the poor, will always be with us. And it's one of the constraints that we operate under. It's also clear that if we're to assert that this mysterious, larger set of considerations we call social structure has an effect on the immediate interactional situation, we should be able to demonstrate the consequentiality of that effect, namely how it affects the talk. To that, I would like to add just a couple of observations. One of the issues involved in assessing consequentiality is the terms of that assessment. That is, what are we looking for? Heritage's remarks, we see one kind of suggestion that the setting, institutional setting, these constrained purposes that participants interact may involve a narrowing or re-specification of the mechanisms of ordinary conversation. I think there are a number of ways in which institutional settings may affect talk. One of them has to do with the distribution of particular mechanisms. I think at one point or another, one cannot avoid addressing certain kinds of distributional issues. In the materials that I'm most familiar with involving this request, response, and inserted interrogative series is one of the basic features of the interaction. What we have here is something that we can find elsewhere. The interesting thing is that we find it predominantly, if not overwhelmingly, in this particular kind of interaction. If we look further at that kind of interaction, we can see that there are other effects that appear to be visited upon the mechanisms of talk. In principle, any utterance is repairable. One of the notable features of the work of repair is that we lack a theory of trouble. That is, we can recognize when a trouble source is identified by the repair response, but it's difficult to identify independently of the participants what such troubles might be. It is not a violation, I think, of the spirit of the analysis to suggest that one could identify trouble independently of its repair. If one had the sufficient information grounded in the detailed analysis of interaction in a setting, which would permit you to recognize where such troubles occur and what their shape is likely to be. In the case that I'm most familiar with, these repairs, these troubles revolve around the contingencies of response to the request, having to do with where to send emergency equipment and what the nature of the problem is. In this regard, we find also an interesting spin-off of that, namely that if you look at the distribution of types of repair, this work is done by Wayne Mellinger, you find that there are some interesting asymmetries. While both the caller and the complaint taker across these calls tend to self-repair, initiate repairs of their own utterance at roughly the same frequency and roughly the same rate, when you look at the initiation, other initiations, and other repairs, one finds that overwhelmingly the other initiations are being done by the complaint taker, not the caller. And these initiations are not marked by such things as delays. They're immediate and they're seldom, if ever, mitigated. They are right out there, hard repair. I only suggest, I'm talking about this only to suggest that there are a variety of ways in which we might examine the consequentiality of an institutional setting or a social structure. I'm going to now talk about one more thing and then yield to the distinguished panel for their commentary, and then we will open it up to the floor. There is the recurrent constraint that we provide for any claim we want to make about a piece of talk by reference to the actual situation of the talk. And I have no, in principle, quarrel with that claim, except to note that it has to be, I think, examined a little more carefully. As Gail Jefferson was suggesting, there are certain things that seem to be going on intuitively, which are very difficult to demonstrate directly, particularly when what's going on is the absence of an action which is not mandated by some prior occurrence in the conversation. I want to trace part of this back to the circumstances of the field in which I take to be the broad majority of the materials analyzed consist of this or that interaction in settings other than institutional settings, so that you have a great diversity of interactions between persons, both face-to-face and on the telephone. In such a case, you essentially have episodes, perhaps complete conversations, and an array of them across a variety of individuals, a variety of social identities, a variety of purposes at hand. In fact, the variety or diversity is such that one could say for all practical purposes that such things as identity or motive or purpose are random. And thus one is free then to look solely at the contingencies of interaction independently of those kinds of considerations. In any event, in most cases, those issues are not directly available in the talk itself. Lacking a knowledge of the biography of the parties or their purposes at hand, one would be in a shaky position to try to interpret them. Now for the relevance of things that are not in the transcript. What is outside the actual occasion of interaction? What is outside the actual occasion of interaction are other occasions of interaction, which is to say people interact in a given situation having interacted in other situations in the past. There have been increments to their knowledge. There are variations in their intents. One solution, and it's not a total solution, is to be able to connect episodes of interaction, because what is difficult to demonstrate in one may be crystal clear by seeing, say, the immediately subsequent interaction. I'm going to give you a very brief example of that. And this, again, comes out of an institutional setting in which there are repetitive events occur repetitively, roughly of the same kind, one after another, and it's possible then to collect and track them in ways that may not be possible in less stringently organized settings. I mean, organized in the sense of a formal organization, not in the generic sense of organization. I have a call here. I'm just going to give you a few details of it. You have the answering Mid-City Emergency. The caller says, oh yes, I would like to speak with someone about having a car come out to the Andrews Hotel, please. Hold on, sir, the complaint taker says. At the Andrews Hotel? Right. In the lobby? Correct. And then he goes on to explain the problem. Now, there are several issues here that I can't get into in any depth, other than to say that there is an ambiguity that I'm going to claim for the opening of the call, in which I could justify, I think, when he says, I would like to speak with someone. The ambiguity has to do with who it is that's calling, and where the crucial issue here is this someone who's speaking on behalf of an establishment like the Andrews Hotel, or is it simply someone else like a guest? I want to say in the lobby is doing at least two things. One is establishing contact for the responding officers, but two, it's dealing with his ambiguity about the situational identity of the caller. This identity is crucial because the nature of the reported event and its implications for the police change according to those identities. Now, one might want to argue that there's enough warrant there for saying that's going on, given the other call. But I'm saying that there is a resource we can check, because this interaction, I will argue, is oriented to, at least by the complaint taker, as an interaction in terms of which she is going to generate the resources for a next action she has to take. And that next action is to dispatch the emergency equipment. Let me read you the response, the dispatch. This is done on a computer, and it's sent to the car. It's a very mediated form of interaction, if it indeed is even an interaction. But nevertheless, it's an act. You get St. and 14th Street, St. Andrews Hotel, the address and the name, theft, priority one, see desk clerk. Now, nowhere in that interaction has anyone identified themselves as a desk clerk. She didn't ask whether he was a desk clerk or not. What she did ask was in the lobby. And one can then begin to infer the kinds of common sense knowledge involved, where then she could see that if it indeed is someone there and they're in the lobby, and there are also some clues that he gives after she asked in the lobby, that indeed they are dealing with a desk clerk, and therefore the status of that particular complaint is relatively unproblematic. Namely, you have, in effect, the agent of an establishment complaining about the behavior of someone in that establishment according to various norms. All I want to suggest is that if we can examine the connection between occasions of interaction, we may find that what people knew before and what people do after can bear upon the understanding of what they're doing in the instant case. And with that, I want to turn it over. There was a discussion beforehand of who would go next. Do I have a volunteer? Some help.
I don't know what to do with all that light. I would like to review my understanding of what I take Ethno and CA are up to as radical enterprises. I want to say it very quickly, and then with that in hand, I want to introduce a ghost that's been walking these meetings for the last several days. And I think as soon as I point out the ghost, you'll all be properly frightened and want to do something about exercising that ghost. I want to introduce that ghost by talking about the ethno-mishigas, the lunacy, the thing now that a company over the years since about 63 has been developingly at work bringing out. And it goes something like this. For those of us who were brought up in sociology, very early on, we were introduced to a very big project that sociology was engaged in, which is, as we were introduced to it via something called the sociology of knowledge, but that's neither here nor there. The project was that the sociologists were undertaking to address and to make eligible for the examination any and every topic of order, logic, reason, method, evidence, proof, repetition, hierarchy, all of it having these great histories among academics and, of course, others, but principally having these great academic histories. And what they were proposing to do was to take any one of these topics, no matter what its history, rational action, for example, reason, and add to it the suffix, in and as the workings of the immortal ordinary society. So instead of just reason absolutely disengaged, reason as Plato told to us, no, it wasn't going to be that. It was going to be reason in and as the workings of ordinary society, evidence in and as the work of ordinary society, storytelling in and as the workings of ordinary society. All of this, then, each and any of it, was then to be addressed as now no longer as established topics in academic histories, but as achievements of the society. That's what the sociologists were up to. What they were going to do and did in addition was to recommend a certain way in which these topics were to be re-examined as achieved phenomena of order. And that those methods we've come to gloss as the methods of constructive analysis. The idea was that these methods addressed to these phenomena would rediscover them and re-specify them as achievements of the workings of it, that they would be re-specified as details of the society as of which they had their presence and their development. Then Ethno and CA chose to undermine that proposal. What they proposed was there was an alternate technology, that constructive analysis was itself a part, a detail, a standing detail of the very ordinary society as of which it was purporting to bring under an examination so as to exhibit the analyzability of its ordinary affairs as the details of modeling, definition, quantitative distributions of every sort and so on. And now, if you permit just that kind of a sketch version of that program, we come to this conference, standing proxy for about the last 10 years of increasing concern as a company to come to terms with the avid results by persons who will do those studies. They just want to do those studies. And so they've been turning out the studies. with the result now that there's a large corpus of stuff, and there are now within the company the attempts to turn those topics into materials that can be taught in academic departments. Now, I take that to be very serious. I'm not talking ironically. I'm talking about the working circumstances within which these studies can and are getting done. Well, the idea of it being, that this corpus is now available to parties, to persons in departments, and there's now the practical initiatives to prepare that stuff to be taught as topics in departments, means that it, as I see, carries a very important, unavoidable, never mind relevance, an unavoidable, beastly fact of life, and that is that the departments we're talking about are, in the first case, teaching arrangements. They're not research arrangements. They're places in which undergraduates make up the work commitments of the day, and the graduates are taught in such a fashion as to make it possible for those staffs that are teaching undergraduates to be replaced. And the topics, then, are those that are found in the National Association's annual meetings, having the blessing there of what can properly make up the evident existence and visibility of good work. And within that setting, the ethno and CA must somehow or other manage the living. I'm not talking the life of, you know, the fact that the morning looks good and the evening looks less good. I'm talking about surviving in departments. And that's the ghost. The question is, what are the studies that we can be doing and have been doing as compared with what do these studies, what is it about studies that might, that have been done that make up or make for surviving in departments? I think that's one issue that we should somehow or other be paying some attention to. In addition, there are the endless devices, the maneuverings, the attempts where the ethno has some representation in departments to in fact survive in those departments. So you have not only the search for the topical matters, the research devices that have been used in the past that might be used now, let's say, to produce interesting studies, let's say, with which to survive in departments, but also how those can be used or might be used to come to terms with a very big, nasty, increasingly oppressive problem, and that is how to assure that these beautiful souls that are committed to doing studies and want nothing more in this life than to do those studies and to have their own way with the studies, to find the initiatives out of a discovering procedure or in the promise of a discovering discipline, to find their way to their own vision of their life's work. Now, how to do that and still assure that they can earn a living? And it seems to me that's, in fact, a very nasty ghost on the one hand. On the other hand, it throws a lot of light on why there should be a company with such a large number of different initiatives, though nevertheless this great willingness to come together and teach each other just what's what. You know, you're a bunch of very opinionated people when it comes to say who's doing good work and whose work is not so good and so on. That's not what's interesting. What's interesting is that you'd stay around for 4 days doing just that.
Take up too much time at this point in the proceedings. I think from my point of view it's been nice to be a problem of the discipline for 4 days. But nonetheless, I have a sort of problem which is rattling around in my mind, which relates almost to the title of this conference. And I think it goes back to something which Manny's been saying for quite a while, and which certainly I've been feeling for quite a while too. And that is how far you can really say that there are two separate things, talk on the one hand and social structure on the other hand. I would want to really say that, to begin with, what CA is doing is studying social structure, or square the title of a book that Max and I edited, Max Atkinson and I edited, we're studying social structures. And so that would be really a first observation that I'd want to make, that really talk and social structure are not two things which are disjoined from one another, even at the most elementary level. We are, in fact, dealing with social structures in the most detailed and minute facets of conversational organization. That's what we're dealing with. So that's number one point. Then we come to the problem of talk in institutions, the second order of problem. Listening to Tom's talk just before the break, it dawned on me in a rush of blood to the head that one way and another the institutional order which as it were envelops the talk, the various sequences of talk which he describes, doesn't envelop it in a kind of on-off way, but it envelops it throughout each utterance of the talk, that in a variety of ways, I want to see I would want to see ways of finding that it is a judge and a counsel, or that it is a police and a dispatcher, in and through each utterance, rather than at particular points in the talk. And so from that point of view, I want to, how should I put this? I should want to see analyses of institutional talk show, as it were, the invasion of the institution into the details of the talk as far as possible. Now, as far as possible leads me to the third and last point that I want to make, and that is this, that part of, and this goes, I think, to a talk, to Gail's talk of a couple of days ago, part of the way in which institutions can get seen in talk has to do with absences as well as presences. And absences are particularly difficult kinds of things to deal with, as Don also mentioned just now. And I'm not quite sure what it's going to take to deal with absences in the long term. All I know is, or what I would want to propose to you as an article of faith, although it's not something which I could have any chance of saying any more about, is simply that I think we're on the right track in the pursuit of those absences, in the ways in which we're working right now, and that one should persist with the pursuit of absences in the study of institutional data. Okay, thank you.
I got four things I want to say. Nitty gritty. Getting down to nitty-gritty things. One principle
operates in lots of settings of talk and interaction, which, despite the fact that we're up here talking at you, this is not